From the Mutual Broadcasting System, this is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, and today I'm going to focus on one thing. This is borderlines on breaking news, although I don't think it really is breaking per se. It's stuff that's been kind of building. Although I will say this, it's difficult sometimes to divine what comes out of Washington, D.C., if it's real or if it's just rhetoric, if you know what I mean. But certainly the rhetoric has been coming out that it's going to change. So let me get right down to it, and I'm going to talk about our Ukraine policy and what has shifted and what has changed. Real quick, I'm going to use the acronym BLUF, bottom line up front. What was just announced today at the White House, but it kind of been sort of, I don't know, I say kind of teased, if you will, over the weekend and at the end of last week, was that the U.S. is going to sell arms to NATO or through NATO to get those weapons into Ukraine. And there's a variety of different ways they're going to do this, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But basically, the concept is very simple, that European NATO nations will come up with the money to pay for U.S. arms to go to Ukraine. That's what it really boils down to. We're also, you may have recalled, I've mentioned this many times, certainly on the air, I don't recall if I've talked about it on STRAT, but I probably have, the U.S., there's legislation in Congress, certainly in the Senate. I think they've got, I just saw something today, it said 86 sponsors of this bill. That's just unheard of with the amount of partisan divide that you hear in Washington, that you get a Senate of 100 senators, you get 86 senators to all agree on something. But they have agreed on this thing to set up secondary tariffs on Russian, primarily on Russian oil, but it also has to deal with trade with Russia and anything else that someone gets from Russia. And it is a very coercive tool. Now, the one that's in the Senate right now is for a 500% tariff on any country that uses Russian oil and gas. What I heard today was a 100% tariff. Either way, those are pretty significant tariffs, whichever way that ends up being. And I should note as a backdrop on this, and I'm going to get more on backdrop, but one of the things, too, is there's been a lot of stuff out just recently in the last few weeks about how bad the Russian economy is, that even the official economists, if you will, those who describe what's happening in Russia, senior Russian officials that describe the economic condition of Russia, have pretty much indicated that they're expecting a full-on recession, which in Russian rhetoric means you could be looking at a massive depression in the Russian economy. And so it's really, really bad. And whereas Russia has been making some gains on the battlefield, they have been doing so at horrendous cost. And Forbes just recently put out something that said, at the current pace of Russian offensive actions, it will take them 89 years to take Ukraine. So, in other words, don't hold your breath. Russia, they've thrown everything in the kitchen sink. And with Russia, they're so desperate for any weapons on the battlefield. I don't rule out that somebody would have taken a kitchen sink out there, but they are not making great strides on this. Now, on background, on Ukraine, just in case anyone's forgotten, when President Trump came into office, you know, he had campaigned on the idea that on day one, there would be a peace deal with Russia and Ukraine. Or before he took office, there would be a peace deal with Russia and Ukraine. Or within the first 100 days, there would be a peace deal with Russia and Ukraine. And obviously, nothing like that happened. There was no peace deal. There was never a ceasefire. Russia did a couple of really strange things where they declared unilateral ceasefires, which was pure rhetoric because nothing was actually done. It was just pure rhetoric that they put out. But nothing ever happened there. And now, Donald Trump has a long relationship with Russia, and a fairly long relationship with Putin himself that goes back before he was actually president in the first term. And I think that he thought that his rapport, his relationship with Putin was so strong and so influential or whatever, that he would be able to convince Putin to stop this thing. And what he's clearly realized over time is that Putin is dead set on this imperialist aim, that he sees himself kind of as a modern inheritor of Stalin, Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, whatever, all the great Soviet, Russian imperial expansionist leaders of the past. And he sees himself in that same mold, putting back together the Russian Empire after the fall of the Soviet Union. So that's kind of how he sees himself. Now, obviously, Trump is not thrilled with Ukraine. As you recall, the first impeachment of President Trump was over a phone call that he had with President Zelensky. And that was something where he asked him for information that was, clearly seen as partisan intent. And he was going to withhold sending Javelin missiles to Ukraine unless they sent that over. And of course, that led to the full impeachment hearings and everything else. And so he's for reasons, he's always had strong feelings about President Zelensky personally, but also about Ukraine. Not the feelings he does not have or has had about Russia. So, from what we've seen initially, it looked like President Trump and some of those around him saw the problem with getting a peace deal done when it didn't happen so fast as a need to put pressure on Ukraine to concede territory and things like that. And as some have said, and for right or wrong, they said it's a very kind of real estate-centric sort of view, which is you give up some of this land and then you get this in return. And this led to a lot of moves to include withholding aid to include arms shipments, withholding intelligence sharing at one point, and a lot of it. And even with kind of the backdrop to that famous Oval Office meeting where it turned into kind of a shouting match at President Zelensky when they were trying to get a minerals deal done. Anyway, let's just say there's a lot of history that goes into that. But one of the underlying themes, away from all that, all the rancor, one of the underlying themes that the Trump administration has had is that the U.S. should not be paying for all these arms. Now, one of the things he does over and over again, he says the U.S. has spent $350 billion on sending weapons or aid to Ukraine. I don't know where he gets that from. That the numbers seem, even at the most, optimistic, they seem to be about double whatever we have put in there. But somehow he keeps coming back to this, and I just heard him say the same thing again in announcing his policy. But I don't think we've done that unless they're rolling in something that I'm just frankly not seeing. I haven't seen it. But nonetheless, the policy has been consistently, he doesn't feel that the U.S. should be paying for the aid that we're sending Ukraine. And he has always said, going back to his first term, that the Europeans need to be paying their fair share. And he also has said, look, this Ukraine thing is a European issue, and he really wants to put the burden of Ukraine on the Europeans. And part of that famous minerals deal, which eventually did get signed, was to provide consideration to the U.S. for the investment that we made in Ukraine. Also, from a Ukrainian standpoint, it was to make us a stakeholder in Ukraine's future, so they wouldn't walk away. And maybe that's kind of worked. I don't know. Anyway, more recently, it's been somewhat of a tumultuous 6 months. But what has happened is that whatever sort of vague language was coming out of the Kremlin, out of Putin himself and his Putin spokespeople, that has shifted. They have gone right back into their maximalist rhetoric. And I should mention that he doesn't see Putin himself and certainly those around him don't see Ukraine as a separate nation state. They really don't see it as a separate culture or national entity or anything like that. They just see it always as part of Russia. And historically speaking, it has been part of Russia for many, many years. What I should mention in this is if you look at Rus, the Rus state or the Rus nation or the Rus empire, going back was originally, as nearly a figure, was founded somewhere in what's now Ukraine, the Kiev area or something. And that was, I believe, by Norse Vikings had set up a settlement in there. And that's where you start seeing the first nucleus of a Russian state or Russian empire was in that. So there's a long history there as to why they view Ukraine as an integral part of the Russian nation or the Russian empire. Also, when Stalin was there, and you have to remember, Putin somewhat idolizes Stalin and all the brutality that Stalin represented. The Ukrainian famine, or the Holodomor, that lasted from really the early 1930s, depending on when you think it actually kicked in. 32, 33 was probably the biggest, but 30 to 33 is kind of the larger Soviet famine that centered on Ukraine. And a lot of that was forced collectivist agriculture that just did not work at all. It was an absolute disaster. But that famine, by UN estimates in 2003, they went back and they said it probably killed about 7 to 10 million people. So that was a huge famine. And when you juxtapose that with the amount of death, suffering, everything that has occurred in Ukraine over the last 3 years, I think in Putin's brain, he goes, well, it's not as bad as what Stalin did, and maybe he thinks achieving what Stalin did is his goal. I don't know. The guy's pretty ruthless, to say the least. But that's how it was. That's how they did it back then, and that's what they did. And that was to, in part, crush Ukrainian nationalism and crush any Ukrainian resistance to the Soviet Union. And frankly, it did work. All right. Now, Trump has clearly come to realize that Putin has been, what was the term he used? Tapping him along, playing him, if you will. And he's specifically talked about he has nice phone calls with Putin, gets off the call, and then that night you see the biggest wave of missiles and drones that attack Ukraine and Kyiv that have ever been seen, causing massive destruction, to cause death, suffering, everything. And so he has finally realized that that is Putin's real answer, is look at the actions, don't look what he's saying. Of course, many of us would probably say you should have not listened to him at all, because you can tell when Putin's lying, his lips are moving, if you will. But yeah, I mean, Russians never, historically speaking, and certainly certainly with this group, not a group that you take them at their word. I think President Reagan used to say, trust but verify, when they were doing the the strategic arms limitation talks. That's exactly how you should deal with the Russians. You know, you may kind of trust them to a certain extent, but you always verify if it is. And it certainly, in this case, they have not met the verification thing. So anyway, this week Trump met, you know, Monday he met with Mark Rutte, the chief, if you will, of NATO. They had a very successful meeting. That's where this big policy change was announced. It is a shift from where we were before. If you may recall, it was just last week that the Pentagon had actually shut down shipments of NATO's of weapons to NATO. It had actually turned around and said, we're going to stop our weapons shipments to NATO. And obviously that caused a lot of things, not the least of which was President Trump had to step in and rescind that policy very publicly, which kind of put a lot of attention on Secretary of Defense Hegseth as to why was the Pentagon doing this, kind of unilaterally, but that's a whole other discussion. Right now, it sounds like the European nations, Germany being the biggest, but I've heard a number of other smaller nations, Denmark, Finland, Norway, others, are putting up money to buy weapons, specifically air defense weapons, but also a host of other weapons that will be sent into Ukraine, and that the U.S. is actually sending some Patriot missile batteries directly into Ukraine. And depending on which line and block chart you see the weapons going directly to Ukraine, but the reality is the weapons will go to Europe first, particularly into Poland, and then they get shipped from Poland across the border into Ukraine. That's how those weapons always get there. So, you know, both physically and financially, the U.S. is not dealing directly with Ukraine on this. It's an indirect sort of thing. This comes on the heels of NATO, European nations and NATO all agreeing to go to the 5%. In 5% gross domestic product investment in their defense needs. It doesn't mean they're all doing it tomorrow. And with Spain, it's kind of questionable if they're going to do it at all, because they seem to have backed off from that pledge that they made. But pretty much that's what it is. And there's been a lot of rancor with the European nations, with NATO, and they have been underinvesting forever. There are some certainly within the GOP that have termed some of the NATO nations as freeloaders, quote unquote, if you will. So there's a lot of frustration there with NATO nations not putting the amount of money in that they should. This was a big step, and I wouldn't be surprised that if in the back rooms they were kind of working on this deal while they're getting the agreement on the 5%, I wouldn't be surprised. would also remind everybody of the $300 billion of frozen Russian assets that about $260 billion are in Europe. And whereas they've been using the profits of those assets to pay for arms to go to Ukraine, been a lot of discussion about actually using the assets themselves to pay for either arms for Ukraine, reconstruction for Ukraine, or both. And there's now a 50-day deadline. If within 50 days Putin doesn't agree to a ceasefire or something like that, then President Trump said he's going to put 100% secondary tariff. That will really hit China and India very hard because they rely on a lot of Russian oil. And so this is going to do a number of things simultaneously. Number one, it's going to bring in Xi and Modi, the chief, the head of state for the People's Republic of China and India, respectively, into this being stakeholders in trying to get Russia, force Russia, compel Russia, influence Russia, whatever, to do some sort of ceasefire agreement. All right, so that's going to happen. I don't know how strong that will be, but that's some of what's happening there. The other thing is, if he doesn't do something in 50 days, I think that kind of opens up the significant possibility that the Europeans might decide it's time to make a decision on that $260 billion. And if they decide to use that for funding that would pay for the war, at that point, Russia's, they're done. There's no way Russia can keep up this war effort if Ukraine is that well funded. And frankly, if Russia loses its oil revenue from China and India, it's somewhat dubious how Russia would ever maintain its war effort against Ukraine. So there are some, there is a little bit of, I think to use a fake term that was under the Bush administration, strategery. I think that was just something that was made up at the time. But there is something that, a little bit of strategy here on multiple levels. Now, Congress originally put out 500% secondary tariff. President Trump's talking 100%. I'm not quite sure if they're going to change the legislation. Not sure which way that's going to go. But I do think that that this is going to definitely put a lot of pressure on Russia to come to the negotiating table and come up with some sort of deal. And then something I want to bring up. Right now, what Russia's doing, their plot has been to use massive waves. I mean, just the biggest waves of primarily drone strikes, but also a lot of missiles into the major cities. They've been going after civilian sites. They've been going after critical infrastructure. They haven't really, I mean, there's no even pretense that they're going after military targets or targets that are, you know, under the international laws of war or what we call, you know, targets that are permitted. They've just been trying to terrorize Ukraine across the board. One of the things that's happening, and it started this last spring, is that, or I should say this year, but really kind of picked up this last spring, is the use of anti-drone lasers. And not that I want to sound like anything from an Austin Powers movie, but these lasers have a lot of utility in some of these lighter drones, which Russia has a ton of, that they're using, the Shahed drones and things like that. And if they can actually kind of break the threshold of getting these things out there, instead of having to rely on missiles and stuff like that, which are very expensive in many cases, you know, they're using a missile to take out a drone when the missile costs 10 or 20 times more than what the drone is that's taking out. If they can do something that is extremely low cost, efficient, and reusable over and over again, lasers don't take any weapons that have to be shipped from the West. Once it's there, it just keeps getting used over and over. It's a laser. That could make a big difference. And if they could neutralize the impact of drones, I think that could make a big difference in terms of the overall situation on the ground. I think it'd make a difference in the big cities, but I also think it'd make a difference on the battlefield as well. And there is a special battlefield drone, a turret-mounted drone that they can put on vehicles. I'm sorry, turret-mounted laser anti-drone system they put on vehicles. And I think that with all this said, that's kind of happening at the same time. That's within that window of 50 days. We'll see how fast this stuff gets fielded. If it starts to make a big difference in diminishing the amount of Russian drone damage, inflicted damage that's done. But that's all happening as well. Thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I've covered a lot of stuff talking about U.S. policy shifts, NATO policy shifts involving Ukraine. Please follow me on stratpodcast.com. Anywhere you get podcasts, you can find Strat. Also, you can go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kiempfert TV. And you can also go to my website or my company's website, Global Risk Intelligence Planning, which is GRIPSA, GRIPSA.com. So please follow what we're doing. And I am doing lots of stuff on the news. In fact, I got a news interview coming up very shortly after recording this. Anyway, follow what's going on. And we live in interesting times, to say the least.